Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Internet Talk Radio coming to you from Göteborg in Sweden at the freezing top of the European continent. It's good to have you all with us today. I hope you've enjoyed Samhain or Hallows Eve or All Saints Day, whatever you're celebrating, and that you're comfortable wherever you are and ready for another interesting radio program. If you're new to Red Ice, either the website or this radio program, I suggest you go to our website and read more about what we do and take a good look around. Check through our radio archive. We have a year of free radio programs up there for you. And we have a lot of material available in our member section as well. Video interviews, webcasts, films, and over 400 hours of radio. And of course, don't forget to follow along in our busy news section as well. So again, you can find all information about this on our website, www.redicecreations.com. Okay, and today we are going to talk about some biblical themes with the author and researcher Patrick Heron from Ireland. He's been interested in Bible prophecy and the end times since about 96. He has four books behind him. The most recent one is called The Return of the Antichrist and the New World Order, and we're going to focus on this in our second hour today. But we're going to begin to talk about his previous book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, first. We've been following the Nephilim theme on and off almost since the inception of this program, so it's going to be interesting to return to this topic and hear more about this today. Patrick's website, by the way, is neph.ie, Neph, short for Nephilim, neph.ie, where you can read more about his background and his books, of course. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Henrik, it is absolutely wonderful to be with you here from Dublin in the Emerald Isle, and I would like to say hello to all your listeners out there in Internet Radio Land. And I have a question for you, Henrik.
Yes.
How come you Swedish people speak better English than we do?
Well, I don't know if most do, but some might do. No, I don't know. The dialect thing is absolutely interesting, but it sounds fine, and I think our listeners today won't have any problem hearing what you're saying, Patrick.
Well, I mean, all the Swedish people I've met, they're usually blonde with very attractive figures and nice bosoms and stuff like that, and they all seem to speak excellent English with a slight American twang. I guess that's from watching American television. I don't know.
I think it is, too. Well, I've got a sexy bosom, so, you know, it's all about that. Huh?
Yeah, well, we won't go there, okay?
Okay, that's for sure. Okay, well, really enjoy having you here, Patrick, and I'm definitely looking forward to this program, diving into some of these themes here that we mentioned here at the beginning of the program. And just maybe to give a little bit of a background on you, maybe you can just mention briefly for us how you kind of got into this subject, and from there we can of course dive into your book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse.
Well, I'll tell you how I got into it. Basically, I have been a Christian since 1976. To make a long story short, around 1973, 1974, I had long blonde hair. I was into sex, drugs, rock and roll. I was in America as a student for 3 months in 73 and had a fantastic time there. I went back, you know, meeting lots of pretty American girls who thought my Irish accent was very sexy. So I really went, you know, made the full use of that. I went back in 74 and I traveled all around the States. I landed in Chicago, spent a few weeks there, hitchhiked back to Pennsylvania, drove down to Arizona. I lived out in the desert in Arizona for 3 weeks with hippies who used to smuggle marijuana from Mexico to the East Coast. So I stayed with them for a few weeks. That was a very interesting situation there and did all sorts of funny things there. Then I hitchhiked up to Los Angeles where I met a friend of mine from Ireland who was becoming a Christian at the time. And me and him used to do all sorts of things together, including, you know, smoking pot and stuff like that, and, you know, LSD a few times. Not too much. I didn't do anything very heavy. But he was telling me about this, and I thought he was nuts. And then a lot of very weird things happened to us when we traveled around California. And then I hitchhiked from California all the way back to Pennsylvania, which is right across the whole of America, which is about 5,000 kilometers or 3,000 miles in old, old money, as it were. Mm. And we met some people on the way. We got stuck in a very peculiar situation in the middle of California where we're getting threatened by some rednecks who said they were going to beat us up and it was getting dark. And I was scared stiff, but my friend just told me to keep, don't worry about it, Jesus will take care of us type thing. And I said, are you nuts? So anyway, again, a guy picked us up on a motorbike, brought us home. he was a hippie who had become a Christian, and he gave me a Bible. And when I came back to Ireland, I started reading it, and it meant nothing to me. And then in 1976, around springtime, I was reading one night, and I went up to the Gospel of Matthew. And remember, I was a hippie at this stage now, and but I used to read a lot, and everybody in our house read a lot. And I was 24 years old, and I said, okay, God, if you're there, show me something. It's supposed to be your word anyway. So as I read that night, I started noticing things. I started noticing these references where Jesus would say something. It would refer back to the Old Testament, and I checked that out, and it was like a big jigsaw puzzle. So over the course of a few hours, the penny started to drop. I started to begin to see what this jigsaw was about. And then sometime later, I had an epiphany, or I saw the light, or I got born again, or I got saved, whatever you want to call it, like Saul on the road to Damascus. And it changed my life right around. I was up all that night. By the time 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning came, I was down on my knees. Everything I read in the Bible was jumping off the page at me, you know, whereas, you know, prior to this, Jesus Christ was just a swear word to me. And I became a Christian. So again, long story short, I get into doing that for years. Around the mid-90s, I started reading about the prophecies, about the book of Revelation, the apocalypse, because I didn't know anything about them. And when I found out what these prophecies were about, I said I would like to make this available to ordinary people. So ordinary man in the street, Joe Soap, as it were, could understand what was written about these prophecies. So I wrote a very short book called Apocalypse Soon. I got on national radio in Ireland for an interview. The guy gave me a fantastic interview. And at the end of it, he said, I read the book in one sitting and I was gripped. So the book went into the bestsellers in Ireland after that. That was okay. A year later, another publisher came to me and he asked me to write another one. So I wrote another book on the same subject. It didn't do as well. It was, you know, slightly better book, but it didn't do as well because they wouldn't let me on the national radio airwaves the second time. Then around 99, I was in Turkey with my wife and three beautiful daughters, and we were visiting some of the sites in Turkey. And by this stage, I started reading books like Fingerprints of the Gods and The Keeper of Genesis and Eric von Daniken, you know, Chariots of the Gods, stuff like that, which I'd read when I was a teenager anyway. And we were down at a temple in a place called Didyma in Turkey, and it was the Temple of Apollo. And it's broken down now, but they had pictures of it as it was when it was constructed originally. And outside this temple, Henrik, was these huge columns, like the columns you see in Greece on these temples. And there was 10 of them across and 5 deep. In other words, there was 50 of these columns, about 70 feet tall, which is about 70 feet, about, what, 30, 40 meters tall. Huge things in the front of this. And then the temple itself, of the Temple of Apollo, was made out of solid granite that you couldn't get a blade of a knife between the blocks. And I remember looking at this with my wife and my kids, saying, there is no way that guys with hammers and chisels built this. And consequently, I was reading about the Great Pyramid of Giza and looking at the incredible mathematical stuff and astronomical knowledge that is associated with this incredible building. I'll give you some of that in a moment. But when you get in and study it, you'll figure out that there's no way that human beings, that ordinary primitive man or prehistoric man could put this together because it's just impossible. For instance, the Great Pyramid of Giza today, architects and engineers freely admit that there's no way we could build the Great Pyramid of Giza today. With all the money we have, all the technology we have, all the machinery we have, we just couldn't do it. It's just beyond our reach. So for us to believe that ancient Egyptians or primitive man, if you will, wandering in the desert somewhere between the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, dressed in animal skins, could construct this incredible pyramid, yet somehow these same guys had not yet figured out how to invent the wheel. It's like, hello, you know, that's a bit like saying if you give a screwdriver to a chimpanzee, he's going to make a plasma TV set for you. It's just implausible. So I knew there had to be another answer to this. It had to be some other reason for who constructed these amazing buildings. Not just the Great Pyramid of Giza, but we've Stonehenge in England, we've Machu Picchu, In Peru, we have the Nazca Lines down in Peru. We've got huge pyramids, 3 incredible pyramids in Mexico. There's pyramids in China. You know, there's pyramids Guatemala, there's Angkor Wat in Cambodia. There's these incredible anomalies all over the world from ancient times that there's just no accounting for. So being a biblical scholar, I knew a little bit about a secret race in the Old Testament, which are called the Nephilim. And these first pop up in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, where it says there were giants in the earth in those days. Now, the word for giants there is Nephilim. N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M. It's a Hebrew word. So it should read, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. And it says, these became the mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. Okay? So I knew a little bit about these guys, so I started doing some study on them. I started studying a little bit more on the ancient monuments, with particularly in the Great Pyramid of Giza. And I put two and two together, and I got four. And so I believe that my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, by the way, it's sold extremely well. It was number one in the prophecy section of Amazon Books for 2 years in America. A production company in America called Grizzly Adams Productions, they made two TV documentaries and DVDs based on this book. So it's sold very, very well in the United States of America. And I still get emails from people who've read it and, you know, tell me, three people wrote and told me it's the best book I ever read. You know, it's been very, very well acclaimed. And so I believe this is the first book ever, not only proving who built the pyramids, but also why they built them. So that is the sort of background to how I got in. It all started in Turkey, looking at the Temple of Apollo in Didyma.
And, you know, you mentioned some of these megalithic sites around the world, but I guess from your point of view, then you don't even have to go that far because you have quite a few interesting ones in Ireland already. Giant's Ring, Newgrange, of course, and there's tons of other ones. Have you been interested in those sites previously as well, or did this first dawn on you then when you actually went abroad and saw some of this stuff?
Well, I mean, I've been at Newgrange. Newgrange is only literally 30 minutes from where I live. I've read a couple of books by Oscar Wilde's father. I don't know if you guys have heard of Oscar Wilde. He's a playwright.
Yes.
Famous Irish playwright. His father was a polymath, which means he was an expert in many different sciences. He was a optical surgeon. In fact, he pioneered some optical surgery, which they still use today. But he also wrote a couple of books on ancient Irish folklore and legend and history. And he showed many, many, many of the ancient monuments, megalithic and Neolithic tombs in Ireland, which date back to around the same time as the pyramids of Giza. And Newgrange is one of those. In fact, the interesting thing about Newgrange, just to describe it briefly for your listeners, it's about 3 acres in size. I don't know what that is. It's about, say, 100 meters one way and the other, and it's round, and it's a bunch of stones, and there's grass on top of it. And there's one little opening, one little aperture or opening into it, which leads a tunnel into the inner sanctum, the inner chamber, and you've got to bend down and crawl in there. And on one day in the year, when the sun rises, it illuminates the inner chamber. And that one day just happens to be the winter solstice, the 21st of December every year. Mm. And that ties in my opinion, Newgrange with the Mayan calendar, which there's a lot of interest these days because according to the experts, they tell us that the Mayan calendar says that the world is going to finish or cease on the 21st of December, 2012. Now, I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but the interesting thing is that the 21st of December, it connects these two buildings. And of course, many, many of the megalithic sites and like Newgrange, Stonehenge, Giza, and Angkor Wat, and lots of other ones, they all have astronomical connections and mathematical connections. So as far as I'm concerned, these were all built by the same group of people, this mysterious cabal that very, very few people know anything about called the Nephilim.
Yes. And so if we talk a little bit about their background, so to speak, you come from a biblical perspective, obviously a background in that. But do you take into account here, I mean, I do know that you're going to a little bit on the ufology aspect to this as well, of course, and maybe you can tie this together for us. Do you primarily think that this has to do with another race coming from another planet outside of our solar system, even potentially, or are you more looking at this as a demonic force, so to speak, that has been and primarily are interested in Earth and Earth activity. So tell us about this.
Well, okay. Just before I get into that and answer that question, let me give you just a few facts and figures about the Great Pyramid of Giza, because that's central to our discussion here today and to finding the answer to this whole conundrum or enigma.
Mm.
Okay, so then we'll talk about the Nephilim. Okay, first of all, the Great Pyramid of Giza, your listeners will have to picture this in their mind's eye. It was originally finished in a polished white limestone. So it would have been white, smooth, iridescent, and many legends say that its capstone, that the top of it, was finished in gold. So this would be an amazing, awesome, awe-inspiring sight as it stood in the middle of the desert, and it could be seen as from as far away as the curvature of the earth permitted. Gleaming, reflecting the sun, shining, as I say, made of polished white limestone. It would have been impossible to climb up it because you just slide down. Now, each side of the Great Pyramid of Giza is an equilateral triangle which faces exactly to the true north, south, east, and west. In fact, on the north side and on the south face of the Great Pyramid are four distinct shafts. They call them star shafts because they pointed four distinct stars: Sirius, Draconis, Beta Ursa Minor, and Orion. And I've identified three out of these four stars with gods, which appear either in Greek or Roman or Egyptian mythology, and also in biblical, in the scriptures. Each side of the base, the length of the base of each side of the Great Pyramid in cubits is 365.2422 cubits, which just happens to be the exact length of a solar year, including the extra fraction for the leap year. The angle of the slope of the Great Pyramid rises at 10 to 9. That is, for every 10 meters you go up the side of the Great Pyramid, you rise in altitude by 9 meters. And if you take the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 10 to the power of 9, you get 91,840,000, which just happens to be the exact distance from the Earth to the Sun in miles. The Great Pyramid is in almost the exact dead center of the world. It's halfway between the northern tip of Norway, the southern cape of South Africa, the west coast of Mexico, and the east coast of China. And it intersects the 30th parallel, both latitude and longitude. So it's almost in the exact dead center of the world. There's enough stone in the Great Pyramid to build a 6-foot wall or a 2-meter wall from Los Angeles to New York. Hmm. If it were a skyscraper, it would be 42 stories high, which meant it was the tallest building in the world for thousands and thousands of years until the Americans started building skyscrapers. And finally, listen to this. The solution to the mathematical problem of how to square the circle is incorporated within the geometry of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Hmm.
Now, as I say, what we've been asked to believe is that primitive man or Egyptians wandering around in animal skins were able to build this incredible pyramid, yet we couldn't build it today. And somehow these guys did it, yet they hadn't figured out how to invent the wheel. And that's why when you see documentaries about the Great Pyramid, you'll always see these slaves dragging these huge blocks along the ground, you know, which is a total rubbish, Heinrich.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is in the center of the world. It's pointing at stars, you know, how to square the circle is in it. Pi is in there. Everything's in there. And the fellas, these guys didn't have a wheel. I mean, come on, give me a break. If you believe that, I'll sell you some land in Florida, you know.
It's a good one. So obviously there's a huge mystery here in regards to something is off. That much we know at this point. Either we are being not told the whole story about how advanced human beings have been in the past, or we have the other possibility that someone else has been down here and building it. And I'd reckon then that you go for the latter one, correct?
Well, this is absolutely the way it is. Now, as I say, there's a lot of information buried in the Old Testament scriptures about this secret cabal of people called the Nephilim. And as I say, in Genesis 6:4 says, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and they bare children to them. And it says, these became the mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So what this is talking about is, it's talking about the Nephilim. The Nephilim in Hebrew means the fallen ones, okay? Now, these are what I would call fallen angels because they fell from heaven, fell from grace, and fell to earth. And the word Nephilim comes from the Hebrew nephal, which means to fall. hence the fallen ones. Mm. So what the scriptures are saying in the Old Testament is that a group of these fallen angels came to earth, they manifested on earth, and they had sex with ordinary human women and produced offspring. And these offsprings were giants. They were the giants of the Old Testament. Goliath, who fought against David, for instance, would have been a progeny of these guys. So what the scripture is talking about is these fallen angels coming to earth. Now, I don't like the word angel, Heinrich, because as soon as I mention the word angel, all your listeners out there in Sweden and around the world, they'll be thinking of little naked cherubim with no genitalia and a bow and arrow going around trying to shoot somebody in the heart and make them fall in love. Or perhaps they think of some giant big guy with long blonde hair and, you know, 10-meter wings with lights in the background and orchestral music. Well, that's not strictly true. When you get in and study the appearance of angels, in fact, a better translation of the word angel would be agent or messenger. That's what it literally means. It's malak in the Old Testament, agalos in Greek, agalos, hence angel. But because of religious pictures and stuff down through the centuries, we think of these guys with wings. But every time you look at where these guys appeared in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, they always appeared as men. They look like men. They wear clothes.
Yep.
They eat. They drink. And these guys that manifested on earth could have sexual relations with women. Now, what this is, the difference between angels and us is that we are human beings. We're flesh and blood. These guys are spirit. They're spirit beings. They were originally created by God, Yahweh, the Most High God, who is a spirit being. So they're not constrained by the ordinary laws of physics as you and I are. These guys can vanish in and out through walls or go from here to this parallel universe, which is called in the Bible heaven, at the blink of an eye. So what the scriptures are telling us is that they look like us. In fact, I think four times in Genesis, in the first few chapters of Genesis, it says, let us make man in our image, in the image of God made he man. Several times in the New Testament, we are told that we are made in the image of these gods. And when I say gods now, I'm talking about with a small g. So these gods fell to earth, these spirit beings, they look like human beings. I can guarantee you that they are extremely good-looking guys because they were originally created by God, and he always makes beautiful-looking beings. They appeared as supernatural, superhuman, super-powerful gods to the ordinary people on earth. I believe they were irresistible to the women of that time, and they had sexual relations with these women, and they produced offspring, which were giants. Now, this ties in with all the legends of just about every mythology going back to the four corners of the world since time immemorial. And, of course, the whole idea of angels coming to earth fits right in with the Greek and Roman mythology and Egyptian mythology, which we are aware of in Europe, where it talks about the gods came down from heaven. They lived in Mount Olympus and Delphi. Zeus came down to earth. He took Alcmene to wife, a mortal woman, and she almost died giving birth to Hercules. That's where all this stuff comes from. Mm. So what I've done is I've taken the scriptural, biblical information, which has been buried in the Hebrew texts and in the book of Revelation, we'll get into that later on, and put it together so to fulfill the whole of the jigsaw puzzle to show exactly who these people were. Some people call them extraterrestrials. Some people call them angels. They're called demons. They're called spirits. What scripture calls them is the Nephilim, the fallen ones, spirit men who came to earth, had sex with human women, and produced offspring who were giants in size.
So what you're talking about and what you're describing here is a kind of a special breed, if you will, then a hybrid between angels and human beings in that sense. does this to you mean that they have been around for a certain period of time and then vanished, or do you still believe that they're hanging around, a few of them, potentially?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happened to them. Now, these fallen angels, by the way, these guys are part of a group that rebelled with the head of their leader, who has several names in scripture. He's called Lucifer, he's called Satan, he's called the devil, he's called the prince of darkness, he's called the prince of the power of the air, he's called Bel, he's called Baal, he's called the god of this world. He has several different names. The devil, he's called the dragon, he's called the serpent, he's lots of different handles. He's the leader. And according to the Old Testament, at one time he tried to usurp the throne of the Most High God. He had a military coup, as it were, but he failed in his bid, and he was defeated. And we're told that when he fell, he brought a third of the rest of the angels with him. So it was just a small group of these guys that fell to earth at that time. According to the book of Enoch, 200 of these guys manifested on earth. We're told they left their first estate, which is the sort of parallel universe, as I say, called heaven. They came to earth, and they can't go back there. Now, there's just 200 of these guys. Now, they were knocking around, according to my studies, for the best part of 1,000 years, because we're told in the book of Enoch, by the way, the book of Enoch is not in the Bible, but yes. Enoch is directly quoted by Jude in the New Testament. And Jude was one of Jesus Christ's brothers, his younger brother who wrote this, one of the sons of Mary and Joseph. And he quotes directly from the book of Jude, or from the book of Enoch. So that means that it gives a lot of credence to the book of Enoch. And he says 200 of these guys fell to earth, had sex with the ordinary women, and they produced these giants. Now, this happened in the days of Jared, which is about 1,200. He was born about 1,200 years prior to the flood of Noah. So we're told in Genesis then that in the preceding 1,000 years or so, when these gods were on earth, and I call them gods, as I say, with a small g, because these are the gods of Greece, the gods of Rome, the gods of Egypt, the gods of Mesopotamia, the gods of China and the Far East, same thing, avatars they call them over there. And an avatar in Hindi means he who comes from earth to heaven, or from heaven to earth, excuse me. And that's, of course, in their legends over there about gods coming down and having sex with mortal people and producing demigods. So we're told in Genesis that over the period of the next 1,000 years, that these guys infected or afflicted the whole population of the world with their DNA. And we're told that the whole of the earth became extremely violent. There was bloodshed in the whole earth. There was violence. It says there was only evil in man's heart continually. That's how bad it was. And if you read Greek and Roman and Egyptian mythology or go to Egypt, you'll see that it's all about blood. There's patricide, fratricide, matricide. They were killing one another. They were drinking one another's blood. There was a lot of evil going on in the earth at that time. So by the end of the 1,000 years, Yahweh, the Most High God, more or less said, I've had enough of this. It said it grieved him that he had made man on the earth. And he sent the flood of Noah. And he drowned everybody. All the human race was drowned at that time, which may have been 20 or 30 million people. We're told that the progeny of these guys were drowned, all the giants, because they were the hybrids of human flesh and blood and spirit beings, as you correctly pointed out. But you cannot drown spirit men. You can't drown these spirits, because they're spirit beings. And we're told that these spirit beings, these fallen angels, these Nephilim, who caused the sin in the days of Noah, were told that they are locked up, they are incarcerated in this place which called in Scripture, it's called the bottomless pit, it's called the abyss, and once in the epistle of Peter, it's called Tartarus, or Tartarus. And of course, Tartarus ties in these gods with the Greek and Roman mythology, where we're told that the gods are imprisoned in Tartarus because they rebelled against Zeus. And it also fits in with the abode of the dead, the underworld, or the netherworld of Egyptian mythology, where we're told again that the gods are imprisoned in the netherworld, in the underworld. That's where you go, and you've got to cross the river Styx to get to the underworld, and Hades is the keeper of the underworld, etc., etc. Mm. So the scriptural information ties in with the biblical accounts, and that's how we get the full picture. So the original 200 angels, these fallen angels who fell to earth and caused all this sin and violence in those days and had sex with women, are locked up in this subterranean prison called the Abyss or Tartarus. But in the future, in the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 9, these guys are going to be released onto the earth again, and it even tells us the name of the leader of these guys. And this fits in with the name that's given to him in the book of Enoch. His name is Azazel. And that Azazel pops up in Deuteronomy, or rather Leviticus in the Old Testament, chapter 17, I believe, where his name is mentioned 3 times, but it's translated there as scapegoat, where the scapegoat was sent out with the sins of the people into the desert. But in the original Hebrew, his name is Azazel, which is a proper name. Mm. So that's where these guys are locked up, and they are going to reappear out of this place in the future. We'll get onto that later on. By the way, there was a second eruption or descent of these fallen angels to earth after the flood of Noah. Because when you read about what happened on earth after the flood. Only Noah and his family were saved through the flood, by the way. Everybody else in the whole world was wiped out. Just eight souls, eight people, Noah and his family, survived. Then they landed, 9 months or a year later, whatever it was. They began to propagate again. The people began to multiply in the earth again. Then we have the story about Moses and the children of Israel going down to Egypt. They stayed there for a few hundred years. Then they tried to get out of Egypt. Moses was trying to get them out with all the plagues of frogs, etc., etc. Then finally Moses led them out through the Red Sea. They went in and they wandered in the wilderness. And it says Moses sent in 12 spies to spy out the promised land, the land which was originally promised to Abraham for his descendants. And he sent out the 12 spies. And when the 12 spies came back, they said to him, "There's no way we can take this land, Moses. The place is full of these giants. It says we saw the Nephilim there. It says we saw the sons of Anak who come of the Nephilim." And it said, "Compared to these guys, we look like grasshoppers." So because of their unbelief, there was only Joshua and one other guy who wanted to go in and said, "Yeah, we can take this place." The rest of them said, "There's no way we can take this place." So they wandered in the desert for 40 years because of their unbelief. Then, under the leadership of Joshua, when Moses was dead, they went in and they invaded the promised land. They defeated the giants who were all over the land at this time. And they took over the land. And it talks about Og. It tells us in the old scriptures that they killed a fellow called Og, who was the king of Bashan at that time. And his iron bedstead was, oh my goodness, it gives us the dimensions of it. You know, we're still working in feet and inches and feet over there. But his bed was like about 4 meters long, about 5 meters long and about 3 meters wide. It was huge, the king of this guy. I mean, this, you know, you don't want to wake up in bed in the morning beside this fella, Henrik, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
unless,
right.
Unless you're inclined that way. And I mean, I know you were talking about your bosoms earlier, so I'm not interested in your sexuality. But I don't think you want to wake up in the morning with a guy who's about like 5 meters long with his arm around you.
No.
Or
no.
Maybe you do. I don't know.
No way.
I'm just joking.
Yes.
But this guy, so there was a second eruption of these fallen angels after the flood. That's the point. Now, we're not told, here's an interesting point, and I make this in my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse. We're not told that the angels that fell after the flood of Noah, that they are locked up in this place called the Bottomless Pit, or Tartarus. So I speculate in my book that these guys might still be at large. And I speculate that perhaps these are the guys who, you know, were over here in Ireland at one time, who perhaps moved to South America. And then as the onslaught of civilization went out across the world, then maybe they went over to places like Cambodia, and maybe they're hiding out still in some distant, dark, deep forest out in the mountains of Cambodia or somewhere in the depths of Africa or whatever. I'm not sure. But those guys might still be at large.
Hmm. So, yeah, because what you're saying here is that it's not only a Middle Eastern phenomenon, so to speak, it's worldwide society. You think that is because they migrated from place to place, or are we potentially talking about a race of beings that have access to advanced technology, potentially flying machines, in order to keep the whole the global grid, as it were, that they've created around the world with many of these megalithic sites? What do you think?
Very possibly. I think you're right. Well, let me give you one instance. I spoke to you a few minutes ago about Oscar Wilde's father, Sir William Wilde, who wrote two books on the ancient history of Ireland. And in one of the books, he talked about the two most ancient of races that came to Ireland back several hundred years BC, I think. And one was called the Tuatha De Danann, and the others were called the Tuatha Fir Bolgs. And he had a note, and he said, he was speaking about the Tuatha De Danann, and he said, many ancient writings say that the Tuatha De Danann were not real human beings at all, but were what he called sprites or fairies.
Mm-hmm.
And sprites and fairies are ye olde English for spirits or fairies. And that they were expert in the occult, in black magic, in necromancy, and in black arts. And I was discussing this with a young Christian guy from Belfast a few years ago. And I was saying to him that, you know, William Wilde said that these guys were in Ireland, you know, spirits. And this may be the Druids. They were into human sacrifice and all that. They may have been called the Druids, but they were into the occult and magic and all this. And he said, that's right, Paddy. He said, it wasn't the snakes that St. Patrick drove out of Ireland. It was the serpents. See?
Yeah.
Subtle difference.
Yeah.
So St. Patrick came in. He was an evangelical Christian guy who teached the Bible and preached the word of God. He wasn't a Catholic at all. Catholicism only came in here around 1100 AD, and then they ruined the place, you know, and it's still ruined today.
Yep.
But Patrick was a Christian guy, and maybe he came in preaching the Christianity, and he chased the serpents, as it were, out of Ireland. Mm. And then that's perhaps when they went across the sea, because they will tell you, history will tell you, Henrik, that these places in like Guatemala and Machu Picchu and places like that, they reckon they were occupied up until just about 400 years ago.
Mm, that's right.
But then these guys go, and so maybe they're sort of hiding out. Now, I don't know how many of these guys there are, but they're supernatural beings, they're super powerful. So they don't need, I don't think spirit beings per se need flying machines. Maybe they do, I don't know if they do, because they're spirits. They can appear, they can disappear. I've met lots of people who have met these guys. So, you know, that's what goes on. So that's who I think St. Patrick kicked out of Ireland, the serpents. And that ties in with the serpent of Genesis 3. See, we've always been talking about Adam and Eve and the apple and the snake, but it doesn't mention anything in Genesis about an apple or a snake. It talks about a tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and it talks about a serpent. And the serpent is the one we're told up in the New Testament that seduced Eve. That's the literal Greek word. And the serpent is another name for this guy I spoke earlier. Twice in the book of Revelation, he's called the dragon and the serpent, who is the devil and Satan. And Satan is a beautiful-looking, created spirit being. He's an angel, probably very attractive, but he's a spirit being. He's very attractive. Serpent in Hebrew means to hiss, to enchant, a bright, shining thing. So it was nothing to do. Adam and Eve didn't eat an apple and thereby, you know, create the fall of man. It says they were seduced by this beautiful-looking man, bright, shining, powerful, supernatural, superhuman human being who seduced them. And by the way, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the sin in the Garden of Eden was that Eve had sex with this serpent and with Adam, and that she got pregnant with fraternal twins. Now, this is not an unusual thing, because about 10 years ago, a prostitute in New York had twins, and one of them was black and one of them was white, because she had sex with a black man and a white man, one after the other. So it talks about Cain, who was the first murderer, and it says he was of that wicked one, because Cain slew his own brother. He killed his own brother. He was the first murderer. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the sin in the Garden of Eden was that the serpent, i.e. Satan, this beautiful-looking, bright, shining angel of light, he's called an angel of light, had sex with her, Adam had sex with her, a sort of a menage a trois, if you will. She got pregnant with twins, had Cain and Abel, and then when they grew up, Cain murdered his own brother, hence he was the first murderer, and that's why it says Cain, who was of this wicked one. So forget about your apple and your all that stuff. That's all just you know, kindergarten rubbish.
Mm-hmm. See, interesting. So you painted the background picture for us there, potentially what has happened, at least through the mythological record, and how this has been transformed and all that. But what about if we go into a little bit about the purpose of the... well, we're specifically focusing on the pyramids for now, but I guess this could be supplanted across over all the megalithic sites that you've been mentioning so far. What is the purpose of that? You mentioned that there were potentially astronomical sites. They measure calendar years. They're measuring winter, summer solstices, etc. But is there anything more to the pyramids, and what are they being used for? Do you know?
Well, let me answer your last question first. And this has to do with the Great Pyramid of Giza, which is in Egypt, and what that means, and its significance, etc., etc. And this fits in with a very enigmatic prophecy, which is in the book of Isaiah, which says, in that day there shall be an altar and a pillar in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord, and it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto God in that day. Now, the expression in that day is always referring to the last days, the day of the apocalypse, the day of tribulation, the day of wrath, the day of his fierce anger, the day of Jacob's trouble, etc., etc. It's a metaphor referring to the last days. And it says, in that day there shall be an altar and a pillar, and this altar and pillar will both be in the middle of Egypt and at its border. And that this altar is going to be for a sign of God to God in the last days. Mm. Now, how can something be in the middle of a country and at the border at the same time? That sounds
that's
impossible.
That's an enigma there, huh? Mm.
Yeah, well, in order to understand that, you've got to understand that in ancient times, Egypt was split into two. There was Upper Egypt and there was Lower Egypt. And the border that divided Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt ran straight across from east to west. And it cut across the apex of the Nile, where the Nile splits up and goes into the Nile Delta, which goes into the Mediterranean. And the only altar and pillar that's right in the middle of Egypt and is also on that border is the Great Pyramid of Giza. So we're told that this altar and pillar is going to be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts, or to God, in that day, in the last days. So what is the Great Pyramid of Giza a sign of and a witness to? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so in order to figure out this enigma, we jump up into the Gospel of John, which is a something that the Messiah spoke about that many of your listeners might recognize. He said, in my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you unto myself, that where I am, there you will be also. Mm. So he talked about going to this house of many mansions. Now we know that he ascended and went to this place called heaven, which I believe is a parallel universe outside of our time bubble, outside of our cosmos, our universe. Then you jump up to Corinthians, and Paul wrote, and he talked about that we have a house in heaven whose hands were not made by human hands. Then and he says its architect and its builder was God. Mm. Then you go up to the book of Hebrews, and it says Abraham looked for a city in heaven whose builder and maker is God. Then in another place in Hebrews chapter 12, it speaks about this heavenly city. It says, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. So it literally talks about this city being in this place called heaven in a parallel universe. Then you jump into the book of Revelation and you read about what's happening there. It talks about the Messiah, Jesus, going to heaven. He's sitting on the right hand of his Father, who's on a throne. They're surrounded by 24 other thrones with 24 elders on it. We don't know who those guys are because we're not told. They're probably the same guys that it speaks about in Genesis when it says, let us make man in our image, in the image of God made him man. Then we're told that this is surrounded by many myriads and myriads, or many, many of these angels, these spirit men that we call angels. Then at the end of the book of Revelation, it jumps into the future. I'm talking about after the apocalypse, after all the bad stuff that's going to happen during the book of Revelation time. It talks about a new heaven and a new earth in the future. And it describes this city coming down out of heaven, descending onto this new earth. And it describes this city in very, very great detail. This is in Revelation chapter 21. It tells us all the stones this city is made out of. It gives us the thickness of the walls. We're told that it's got 12 gates made out of a single pearl each. We're told that the river of life flows out of it, that the tree of life is there for the healings of the nations, etc., etc., etc. In fact, when you get into the measurements of this city, at the end of it, it gives us the dimensions, rather, of this future city, and we're told its length and its breadth and its height are the same. That is a pyramid in shape, Henrik.
Hmm.
The length and breadth and height are the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you get back to Isaiah 19, and it talks about an altar and a pillar in the midst of the land of Egypt, it's going to be a sign of something to come and a witness to something to come. It is speaking about this pyramid city, which is called the New Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the city of the living God, which is to descend out of heaven onto the new earth in the future, 1,000 years from now. So what I'm saying is that, if you like, there's a connection between the Great Pyramid of Giza and this future pyramid city. The Great Pyramid of Giza is pointing into the future, pointing out this future pyramid city, the New Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the city of the living God. And this city of God is pointing back at the Great Pyramid of Giza. There is a direct connection between the two of them. And my book is the first book that's ever come up with this theory, linking the Great Pyramid of Giza with the city of God, which is in this place called heaven. But what I'm saying is, Heinrich, and this is the distinction, is that when the angels, when the fallen angels fell to earth, originally some 5,500 years ago, that they built this original pyramid with its white, smooth, iridescent stone with the gold pyramidion right slap bang in the middle of the world with the shafts pointing at four particular stars with all the mathematical intricacies and the anomalies, the incredible building it is, but that these guys built this as an earthly representation of a celestial reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because people that are into biblical studies know that Satan, or the devil, if you will, he always copies or imitates or duplicates what the true God does. So when these guys fell to earth, they built this pyramid as an earthly representation of the city that they had come from, because they fell to earth. But they built it as a monument to their own pride, their own ego, and their own hubris. But now, what I'm doing is I'm pointing out in my book that this is actually an earthly representation of this celestial reality, and that it is pointing at this future city which is to come in the future, which is described in some magnificent detail in the second last chapter of the book of Revelation. Hmm. And that fulfills the enigma of the prophecy written by Isaiah some 800 years BC, where he said that in the day, in the end times, there will be an altar and a pillar in the midst of the middle of Egypt and on its border, and it would be a sign and a witness unto God in the last days.
Hmm. So what about the idea that even the pyramid might be working as some kind of, there's theories floating around that it might be a stargate, meaning that it actually is a connecting place between heaven and earth, so to speak, symbolically or actually, depending on how you look at it. But what's your take on that? Does it represent that in the same way, or is this the artificial version then that we've been given by the Nephilim, so to speak, of this city that you're talking about?
Well, it may have other implications. It may be some sort of a portal or a stargate. I do not know, Heinrich, is the straight answer. And if I don't know the answer to something, I'll just tell you, I don't know.
Mm.
Maybe there's a lot of other things going on there, the mathematical stuff. I mean, it points at Orion, Sirius, Beta Ursa Minor, and Alpha Draconis. And by Draconis is one of the stars, which means the dragon, and that's beside the constellation of Serpens, which is the serpent. So the serpent, the dragon, Orion was one of the Greek gods and hunters. Sirius is associated with the goddess Isis, and Zeta Orionis is associated with Osiris, the Egyptian high god of death and resurrection and rebirth. So it's tying all these stars and this building in with gods, with a small g, with fallen angels, the Draconis, serpents, the dragon, the serpent, the Egyptian high god of death and resurrection. And if you go and look at all those things in Egypt, and I've been to Egypt, to the temples, you'll see all these incredible buildings and all this mystical stuff that's going on about them going to the underworld and to the afterlife. So whether it's portals or there's other stuff, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I don't know. I'm not an expert in that field. But one thing I do know is that they all have celestial and mathematical and starry associations.
Yes.
But we've lost a lot of that knowledge now.
And you mentioned, of course, again there, that the remaining Nephilim will be let out first, so to speak. Does this mean that they're trapped somewhere, do you think, underground, or will they come from the heavens again? Or are they somewhere up waiting on another planet, or is there another dimension? And if so, any ideas when this will happen? When will they be let out into the earth again, or onto the earth?
Well, exactly, you are right. I was sort of going to hold this till the second section, but if I can mention it briefly now, if you like.
Yes, we can start going to it, and then we can begin to round things up for this hour. Yes.
Okay, well, basically, what we're told in the book of Revelation, in the Apocalypse, and by the way, that's what basically I write about, the prophecies of the Apocalypse, and also the signs that we are told are going to occur before this time period kicks in, which in my opinion is not too far away. But in Revelation chapter 9, verse 11, or verse 1, we're told that, we're told a star falls from heaven with the key to the bottomless pit. Now, a star is a metaphor in the Bible for an angel, and he falls to earth with the key to the bottomless pit. Regular stars falling in the skies don't have keys. And it says, he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit. And out of the pit comes locusts, and they're given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. They are metaphors for these spirit beings. Then down in verse 11 it says, when they open this pit and the smoke comes out of it. This is Tartarus that's talking about, the bottomless pit. And it says, and they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in Greek is Apollyon. So two things here. It says they had a king over them. Now a king again in the Greek is a ruler, right? This is the ruler of the angels in the bottom, from the bottomless pit.
Mm-hmm.
And it says he is the king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit. And we're given his name. And his name in Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in Greek his name is Apollyon, A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N. But Apollyon, Henrik, is nothing more than how the Greeks spell what we call in English Apollo. And Apollo was one of the original leaders of the original pantheon of Greek gods, along with Mars, Saturn, Pluto, Mercury, Zeus, Poseidon, Jupiter, Sirius, Venus, Athena, Orion, etc., etc. And in Greek and Roman mythology, Apollo was the god of prophecy, the god of music, the god of medicine. He has his oracle at Delphi, which is an incredible place. If you can look it up on the internet, the pictures of it, it's amazing. People used to go there to consult the oracle of Apollo all over parts of Turkey, Greece, Italy are temples to Apollo. They're all over the place. He was one of the main leaders. And we're told that he is the leader of these angels who are going to be released onto the earth. And he is the guy who goes on to be called to become what we call the Antichrist. And as you mentioned earlier, my new book, which is an e-book and costs just €3 to download, by the way, is called The Return of the Antichrist in the New World Order. And it's a study on this fella. He's never called the Antichrist in the book of Revelation. In fact, the words the Antichrist only appear twice in the New Testament. In the book of Revelation, he's got a different name. He's called the Beast from the Abyss. In fact, to give him his full title, he's called the Beast who ascends out of the bottomless pit, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And he's called the Beast no less than 35 times in the book of Revelation. So my new book is a study on this man who is to come, who we call the Antichrist, who's going to be the leader of the whole world, of the new world order, of the one world government, which is coming and which fits in with all the things that's happening on the news as we speak. We call him the Antichrist, but the book of Revelation, John the Revelator calls him the Beast who ascends out of the bottomless pit, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And that's what we're going to talk about in our next section.
That's right. More on Apollyon, the Antichrist, and of course, basically where things are heading here in regards to the New World Order. But tell us your website again, Patrick, and where people can go to pick up a copy of your books if they are interested in reading more about this.
Yes, well, my website is called www.neph.ie. That's neph.ie. And my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, it's written for a secular audience, you know. And the first half is all about the Nephilim, the fallen angels, and Greek gods and Egyptian gods. And there's lots of great pictures in there. By the way, I've got pictures of some of these Nephilim at the back of my book, 3 pictures, because one of the things I didn't mention, Heinrich, was is that in the book of Enoch, when he's describing these gods, he says that they have privy members like horses. Now, a privy member is like, it's another name for what we would call a penis.
A ding-dong, okay? Yes.
A ding-dong. Well, over in Irish, we call it a mickey. You know, it's your mickey, right?
Right.
And so I've got a couple of pictures of these from ancient Egypt, from the friezes of some of the reliefs, the pictures in the temples over there, where we have these gods who literally have a ding-dong or a penis or a mickey, which looks like it's as big as a horse. Now, if your readers get my book and look at these pictures, I don't want you to make any mistake. They're not Irish men, okay? they're not Irish guys. I know, you know, you might mix them up with Irish guys, but they're not. These are actually fallen angels, and they literally are hung like horses. They've got penises the size of a horse. In fact, the very famous one that I have in my book from the Egyptian temple, we're told that this is the god Min. M-I-N.
Yes, and Min, right.
I was tempted to put into my book that if this is Min, I wouldn't like to meet his brother Max.
See what you mean?
Know,
yeah.
Know what I'm saying?
Yes, that's right. Some okay, ancient arousals there for people to enjoy in the back of the book there. That's interesting.
They can get that book on Amazon.com. It's quite cheap on Amazon Books. Or if you want a signed copy, you can go onto my website and buy it. It's only €9.99, and I'll sign it and post it to you. And I've got a couple of DVDs there, and I've got two other books, and lots of good stuff on there.
All right, there you have it. Again, the book is called The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse. The website is neph.ie. NEPH.ie. We'll have this linked up on redicecreations.com. Of course, you can click through from our website easily as well. So with that, stay with us, Patrick, and we'll be back for more in our second hour for Red Ice members. I'm really looking forward to that. That's our first hour with Patrick Heron. We'll continue now to talk more about the Antichrist and the New World Order for our members. Patrick shares with us from his perspective on how things will play out in the future and what the end game of the New World Order is. How the world will be broken up into regions and how they will be ruled over in a certain hierarchy of kings or leaders. We talk about famine, financial crashes, how the different empires have come and gone in history in accordance with the Book of Daniel and the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. We also talk about the G20, their financial New World Order, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the beast, and what the nature of the Antichrist or the world leader will be. So sign up for Red Ice membership if you want to hear more from this interview and all the second and third hours that we've done in the past. We also have video interviews, films, webcasts, and of course our entire radio archive available up there for you. Check out our latest David Icke video interview that we did. This dovetails with some of the material that we'll get into here in the second hour about the religious symbolism in this regard, especially to the EU and how the symbols and origins connects back to the Babylonian-Sumerian system. Very interesting. Do not miss. REDICE Creations. RedIceCreations.com is the website. Click on subscribe, and from there you can read more on how to tune into this second hour. More now coming up with Patrick.